music on monitor, the Baja Marimba Band, bouncing the title off their own name with I'll Marimba You. That's if you have the money, I've got the time to marimba you. Coming your way with Monitor 70. Say, if you would like to improve your diction, I'd like to give you a little exercise for you to work out right now. Say lemon liniment fast three times, like lemon liniment, lemon liniment, lemon liniment. Do that to yourself and see how you come out. In the meantime, during this half hour, while you're doing lemon liniments, the accent is on sports with our man Joe Graziola standing by to give us the word on a rule in tournament golf play that he thinks should be changed. First, though, while you're doing your lemon liniment exercises, we'll have some words and music exercises with the cufflinks and Run, Sally, Run. Lemon liniment, lemon liniment, lemon liniment.
Run, Sally, run. Gotta put your mind together. Run, Sally, run. Run away. Run, Sally, run.
Run, Sally, run.
No one ever cared about you. Run, Sally, run. Run away today. Gotta find understanding. Gotta find love somewhere. Gotta find someone who will show they really care.
Run, Sally, run.
Maybe you can find the answer.
Sally, run. The sound of the cufflinks for you. Murray the K with you, and talking about sports right now. You hear players talk about beating themselves in many sports, and particularly when they're not playing well. But in one sport, golf, a player can beat himself when he isn't even holding a golf club. All he needs is a pencil. And here's Joe Graziola with some further thoughts on the subject.
Sports are played by rules, and it's only right that breaking those rules should be cause for punishment. But it is also true that those rules should have some justification. Now, if the rule is found to be working against the good of the game and the people who play the game, then it should be time to think about changing that rule. Last weekend, the golf tour was in Florida for the Doral Open. Now, there was a pro-amateur event preceding the tournament. After finishing the ninth hole, PGA champion Ray Floyd took out his scorecard. He had shot a 36, but instead of putting that figure in the proper space, he wrote down 36 in the box where his score on the ninth hole should have gone. When the round was over, Floyd didn't spot his mistake and he signed the card. And as a result, he was charged with 36 strokes on the ninth hole and he wound up with a score for the day of 110. The next day, the first round was played. At the very same hole, Doug Ford did the same thing. He had a 3 on the ninth hole to give him a 40 on the front nine. He wrote down 40 in the space for his ninth hole score. So he was charged with 40 strokes on the ninth hole. Even I don't take that many. So while Ford taking 77 strokes, he was charged with 116. Now this tournament is worth $150,000. With that kind of money, which isn't unusual on a golf tour nowadays, it would seem that the PGA and the tournament promoters would be able to let somebody else handle the scoring and allow the golfers to concentrate on golf. There have been other cases over the years. In 1957, Miss Jackie Pung had the lowest score in the U.S. Women's Open. On one hole, she put down a lower score than she had actually made. However, the total score she wrote down was correct. What happened? Well, she was disqualified and didn't get a cent of the prize money. 4 years ago, Doug Sanders was disqualified from the Pensacola Open because he failed to sign his scorecard. 2 years ago at the Masters, after 72 holes, Roberto DiVincenzo and Bob Golby were tied for the lead. That is, until somebody noticed that while DiVincenzo had shot a 65 on the last round, he had added it up to 66. The solution? The tie was broken, and Golby was the champ. Golf is big in the world of sports, and it's getting bigger. And rules like this only hurt the game. If a player does things that are harmful to golf, action is taken. If a rule is harmful to golf, and this one is, then some action should be taken, too. This is Joe Garagiola for Monitor Sports.
Incidentally, all of us here at Monitor send our condolences to Joe Graziola, whose mother passed away this past Thursday. This is Murray the K on Monitor on NBC with more Monitor music. Here's a new one by Jerry Naylor and his orchestra, But for Love.
So it's raining again, and the wind's up in a roar. Swept through the streets to be washed up at your door, but you're within, I know. So I'll call back later on. Why do I need you so? But for love I'd be gone. But for love I'd be gone. Heart cries to me.
Cut for Love. And right now it's 16 and a half minutes after the hour, and you're on the Monitor Beacon. Beep away, little devil.
New York City Finance Administration has the following message for senior citizens over 65 years of age and who own their own residences. You may be entitled to a 50% tax exemption if you file a simple form between February 1st and March 15th in person at any office of Real Property Assessment Department in the borough in which you live. To qualify, in addition to age and residence ownership, you may not earn more than $3,000 annually if single or combined if married. Trained personnel will help you fill out the simple form, and you need hire no special person to do so. From February 1st through March 15th, the office hours will be from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday, and from 9 a.m. to noon on Saturdays.
WNBC, New York.
For Monitor, it's Murray the K. For Governor, it's Nelson Rockefeller. For Mayor, it's... Well, we could go on, but we've got Mary Hopkins standing by right alongside Tima Harbor.
In a giant lemon tree, alone my friend and me, both climbed down and crossed the sand. Waves come high, high as we sway and dance. And the way I feel makes me want to take a chance. To sing a song of Santa Harbor, climb a coconut tree, catch a fish and light a fire, drink some wine.
Hopkins. By the way, now you've taken care of your Tama Harbor, how are you coming along with your lemon liniments three times fast? You know, spring is just around the corner at least. That's the word we get from our monitor meteorologist, phoned in from his winter vacation in Miami Beach. And when spring comes, can baseball be far behind? The answer, of course, is no, no, a thousand times no. Well, all of which leads up to an interview with Larry Barnett, who is the youngest umpire in the American League. And questioning Larry was reporter Bob Braun.
Larry, does being the youngest umpire in baseball have any certain set of drawbacks, any things that bother you mostly?
Well, of course, Bob, I think when the players find out how old you are, they test you a little more than they would an older man that's umpiring. But for the most part, they're happy to see young guys coming up in our profession.
How long does it take to become an umpire?
Well, it took me 6 weeks to qualify to start out in the minor leagues, and then, of course, I spent 5 years working the bushes, so to speak, and before I got my break to come to the big leagues.
Will this be your second full season coming up?
Yes, this is my second season. I'm really looking forward to it.
How about spring training? How's it going?
Well, things out in Arizona are really great. The Indians made a few trades last year, as most of the people know. I think they're going to have a real fine ball club. Seattle looked real well, but I think that Eastern Division of the American League should really be tough this year.
You're only 25 years old, so really you're not too far out of knothole baseball or Bush League baseball in that respect. And I wonder if you had any idols in the American League who perhaps are still playing, and those fellows you have to call out, have to walk, strike out, or whatever. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think probably the guy that I thought the most of, there are a lot of great ball players in the class of Frank Robinson, Harmon Killebrew, but I think Mickey Mantle was sort of always my idol, and Mickey has gone now, and I never worked with him, but to me, he was just Mr. Ball Player.
How did they treat you last year in your first year in the minor league or in the major leagues as an umpire?
Well, I think just like they would treat anyone else when they first come up to the profession, they would like to see you quit and go home at times. But if you hang around and bang heads with them, then they decide that you're going to be there, so they accept you.
You held a record, I believe, for the 1969 season. You threw more guys out of a ball game than any other umpire. Any reason behind that?
Well, I think it was due to the testing that they put me through to see just what I was going to take. And this will sort of set a precedent for me in the future, what they can get away with and what they must do in order to stay in the game.
Any new rules this year, Larry?
No, we have no new rules this year, Bob. They're going to play the game the same as we did last year.
You've been listening to Larry Barnett, who's 25, about to begin his second year as a Major League umpire. He's in the American League, and remember, baseball is just around the corner. What's your pick for 1970?
All right. See, speaking about baseball, when Brooklyn was the home of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they were known as the Brooklyn Dodgers, they used to have, in the stands, they had one of these, homemade bands that were made up of the fans and rooters. And every time the umpires would come on the field, they would play Three Blind Mice. And I wonder whether Larry would throw them out of the ballpark. All right, coming up now is Dennis Yost in the Classics 4. They've had a lot of hits in 69, and maybe 70 will be a lucky year for them, too, with their new one called The Funniest Thing.
The funniest thing happened to me yesterday. I ran into, oh, you know who, by mistake. She was out on the town with her new honey, and on the phone, spending his money. Oh, it was the funniest thing. Calling him baby, leaving him on, driving.
That's the funniest thing, and that's the sound for you by Dennis Yost and the Classics Four. And, you know, before we were thinking about what the name of that band was in Ebbets Field, and Bill Malcolm, Hank Miles, and Bob Sossman, they were trying to figure it out, and I remembered that it was the Brooklyn Symphony. I'll take, fellas, I'm the star of the show, I'll take credit for it, okay? Now, a listening reminder, tomorrow afternoon on Monitor with host Henry Morgan, there'll be a report on penny-pinching in Moscow. Maybe it should be kopeck counting, comrade, and some fascinating facts on the upcoming U.S. Census. Add a theatrical review, a generous portion of our easy-listening Monitor music, and you can see you won't want to miss it tomorrow afternoon on Monitor 70. Coming up now, the old Ronettes tune, new version of Baby, I Love You. By Ronnie Aldrich and his entire orchestra, friends, which is a lot of love they're giving you. You heard it on Nationwide Monitor, heard in Western Nevada and Eastern California and station KOH, Reno. We're going to split for a few moments while you hear a word from the NBC affiliate nearest you. And then we'll have more on Monitor 70. Murray the K here. Don't go bay. You hear?
What's the state of the nation's pocketbook? How is it affecting yours? This is Dean Mell, inviting you to join me for Second Sunday, Inflation, the Economic Plague, tomorrow night on NBC Radio.
You don't need rockets or planes.
Once again, Murray the K from Monitor 70. In this half hour, we've got a surprise for you. A pianist, an all-around entertainer who's made it big in nightclubs, concert halls, our records and TV. And before you meet him, let's listen to him perform and see if you can identify him. The number is A Brand New Me. Thank you. best-known products of Milwaukee are beer, cheese, and our guest for today, Liberace. Mr. Showmanship, as he's sometimes called in the entertainment business, is back here in New York with a couple of new projects on the fire. One is a personal appearance at the Empire Room of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. And we do want to welcome you on Monitor, Lee.
Thank you very much, Frank.
You know, there are so many things I know there are spinoffs in everybody's career. And mm-hmm. one of them, of course, has always been your dress and your clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that a new adventure that you have is going into a line of men's clothing designed to reflect your own, shall we say, unusual taste in fabrics and colors and designs. Is that
well,
true?
Well, yes, I'm moving very carefully and slowly in this project because I'm not anxious to put out a product that isn't perfect. I feel, you know, that the men's clothing has become much more colorful and much more highly styled, and men are becoming fashion conscious.
Yeah, it has. It's so much so. In fact, I recall, Lee, that there was a picture of you in the New York Times earlier this week showing you wearing a suit made of gold and black velour and holding another made of Italian drapery fabric.
That's right.
Where'd you get that idea for that?
Well, I walked into this salon, I guess you would call it, in Rome, and they brought out all kinds of interesting materials and so forth. And when they got all through, I said, they said, well, what do you really like of what we've shown you? And I said, I like your draperies. Do you think you could make a suit out of the drapery fabric?
Mm-hmm.
And they laughed. They thought I was kidding, you know. But they did. And it turned out fantastic. And I brought it to the States and introduced it to some friends of mine who run a boutique in Philadelphia. And they put the suit in their boutique line.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sold out immediately.
Fantastic.
Which shows that men are looking for something different.
I wish this was, in a way, TV, although I don't even think that a television camera could capture the ring you're wearing. That is an out-of-sight ring.
Oh, right? Really?
I don't know, how would you
describe
it? Well,
it's a candelabra, and it's fashioned of diamonds and platinum, and there's practically every shaped diamond in the candelabra. And it was given to me by Bill Hare of Hare's Club in Lake Tahoe.
Right.
And the watch is a piano watch.
Yeah, I noticed that it's a diamond piano top, and then it just opens up.
It opens up. The lid of the piano opens up and reveals the watch.
Which is gold. Usually, you know, there's the old line, what time is it, Lee? And he says, well, it's two diamonds past the ruby.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Will your new line of men's clothes have a particular name?
Well, tentatively, we were thinking of calling it Mr. Showmanship, which is sort of my secondary title.
Uh-huh.
And
include
designed
everything?
By Liberace,
yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
It will include most,
yes.
Every
at
kind?
At present, we're working on shirt manufacturers, and then we're going to go into the jackets, the suits,
uh-huh.
the accessories, the shoes. And then finally, the toiletries.
If you look good, you might as well smell good, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no longer just the idea of a scent.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea of part of your daily grooming. I'm not going into the far-out things like, you know, like false mustaches and things or false eyelashes, but just good grooming aids.
Will you design some of these clothes yourself or suggest some of the designs?
Well, they're going to reflect me in a way, but they're going to not be as exaggerated as my costume that I wear in the shows, but they will be sort of in between the street clothes that are sort of in today and a little bit of the flair of the showmanship.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, fine fabrics, fine materials, and style.
Well, Lee, with the current trends in men's clothing, your venture should be a great success, but don't go away now because we want to hear about some of the other Liberace projects. All of you out there, don't go away either because we want you to stay right here with us on the Monitor Beacon.
Thank you.
got it. Say, Monitor resumes as we continue our conversation with Liberace. Lee, you told us about your new line of men's clothing in the mod manner. Now let's find out about some of your other activities. Let's see, Lee, I understand you have something new and different going for you in the new act you're bringing into the Waldorf.
Well, first of all, there's going to be a new piano that's never been seen in public before. $50,000 concert grand that has been specially designed for me by Baldwin, and it's revolutionary in design. And the only similarity it has to other pianos is that it has 88 keys. But it looks like it's suspended in midair, and it's all held up with plexiglass and all that sort of thing. It's really wild. And then the other shock, of course, will be my clothes. I'm wearing, for the first time, some wild, wild outfits that are not only wild, but very expensive and different, you know. It's an expensive joke, these clothes.
When you talk about that piano, getting back to that, is that someone told me that it's transparent. Is that true?
Well, part of it is transparent. The lid,
yeah.
The legs, and the only solid look it has is the body of the piano, which seems to be suspended.
Oh, I thought for a minute the whole thing was like a peekaboo. It's sort of an old Calcutta type of piano, you know.
It's the
only nude piano in existence.
Well, it has that look. It really does, because there's very little wood on the piano except for the soundboard.
I guess by now everybody knows that you made your concert debut at the age of 11. And when did you actually start your formal piano training?
When I was 4.
Mm-hmm.
And my scholarship began when I was 7 and a half. And I studied at the Wisconsin College of Music. And I made my professional concert debut when I was 11, but with a major symphony orchestra when I was 19. And then I came to New York after playing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and that's when I entered the supper club field. And I started playing places like the Persian Room, the Plaza, and the Waldorf Astoria. And I became known as a sort of a cafe society performer. But I really wasn't happy with this, because the man on the street didn't know me. I recall being at the Waldorf in 1950 and getting a standing ovation one night and feeling real good about the whole thing. And then about a half hour later, I was walking down Park Avenue and I became a nonentity.
Mm-hmm.
And this bothered me. So it wasn't until after television that I became known by the general public. And then I felt that I was doing the right thing.
Well, do you feel something which I guess those of us in show business sometimes have, when you reach a certain peak in your career where you have success and you are recognized, that it is almost like a drug? It becomes insatiable.
That's very true, that you should be that perceptive, because I remember going in a dressing room to pay my respects to Jack Benny, and he was lying down on the couch, quite exhausted. And I said to Jack, "Forgive me for interrupting your nap. I just wanted to say hello." And he said, "Oh, no." He was very charming. "Come in." And he said, "I am tired. I really am tired." So I said to him, "Jack, why do you do it? I mean, you don't need the money."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "If people no longer want to see Jack Benny, I'll just shrivel up and die." He said, "And as long as they come to see me, I feel I have to do it."
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the money anymore.
No.
And I feel the same way. The longer I stay in this business, the idea of being a success, to have security, it disappears. The idea of feeling needed takes over.
Yes, that feeling of being needed is one of the biggest incentives and one of the greatest rewards a performer, I guess, can have. And now, right about here, we've got more of the Liberace touch, and this one is applied to Judy Blue Eyes from his brand new album.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to Liberace here on monitor. Lee, I wanted to ask you a question. You know, there are a lot of things that come into... You've had a long and illustrious career. As far as songs are concerned, are any songs that, like, are your favorites, or any songs that there's a story, particular story attached to that you recall?
Well, I think the greatest song to come along in a long time that has become almost a part of me, and I'm still doing it because I have never found another song to take its place, because I feel it has an association with everybody in the audience, is The Impossible Dream. And I'm doing it at the Waldorf, and it's, everyone has a dream. And my dream has been fulfilled and realized to a degree, but there's still that future something that you think is going to happen that hasn't happened yet. And maybe it'll happen with world travel or meeting new people, new countries, you know. But I feel that this is one of the greatest songs I have ever come across.
The Impossible Dream.
Yeah.
I guess we're all looking for it, aren't we? We still are.
That's right.
Right.